Welcome to the latest podcast from the Watercolors Aquarium Gallery, brought to you from the Aquarium Row Studios in downtown Grand Rapids, Michigan. So if you guys have been listening to some of our podcasts, or at least the last one that we did, you heard us wrap up and realize we had to start over because we needed a part two.
We ran out of time, you guys. We're going to keep going here soon, but...
We're
going
to pull a Deathly Hallows on you here. Yeah.
We just have way too much more to say.
You know, they put the Hobbit into three movies.
So, and that was like a 100-page book, so this should be at least three episodes, right?
Yeah, exactly. No. We're just going to, I promise, we're going to keep this down to just two episodes. But really what we're talking about here today is if you listened last week, you know, but I got to just introduce it so you know what we're talking about. And really, we started having conversations about why people set up aquariums and what the point is and or what the focus is. Focusing on an aquarium that, hey, I just want a fish tank in my house with some plants and a bunch of fish in it. Or I really like community fish, or I want an aggressive tank. But what if we designed aquariums around specific fish?
This is a style of designing tanks that really appeals to me because I have very much skewed away from the like, go in and see what I like mentality, yeah. Which I don't really judge because I was like that, but I just, that's not how I do tanks anymore.
Yeah, we really like sank our teeth into this subject a little bit more than we were expecting. So that's why we're doing two episodes on it. We might have a little bit of an awkward transition into the next part of this, but bear with us. There's definitely plenty of good conversation to come.
It definitely stems from this passion within us to say, we really think fish are cool, and trying to get the natural behavior out of a specific fish is what we're going for here. We're not talking about, hey, I'm going to do a species tank because I want to breed fish. This is about behavior. Mm-hmm. This is about pulling the behavior and focus on a specific fish.
Yeah.
So let's see how it goes. Well, okay, we saw how it goes with part one. If you stuck with us this long, you're listening to part two. So
all right.
Here we go. So it's Charles for the steel.
Yeah, because I think this is a really good transition. I want to talk about the ideal Cory Cat tank.
Oh, cool.
Cool.
You know, I had one of my alternates that I was considering was pygmy Corys.
Yeah.
Oh, and to do a tank focused around pygmy Corys. So I think this is great.
I love it because we talked about Cory Doristerbe and the with Discus, but I also, in my mind, this is going to sound weird, but let me explain. I think a ideal Cory Cat tank, if you're designing around the Cory Cats, mm-hmm. is basically the exact opposite of a Discus tank.
Okay.
I love that.
Done with it?
Mm-hmm. So in my head here, I was thinking, how would I design the ideal tank for Corydoras White's Mani, mm-hmm. which is a cool water Cory Cat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I would have a sand bottom, mm-hmm. and we were talking about Discus weaving through Val. I would want to try to set up, I wouldn't probably even bother with what, like plants in this tank, mm-hmm. because I think you could get a really cool tank if you set up driftwood in it, like manzanita or spiderwood, so it looks like roots coming down. Mm-hmm. So the Cory Cats are snuffling along and weaving their way through
the snuffle, don't they?
Yeah.
That's a great word. That's the way to describe what Cory Cats do. They snuffle.
And I love the idea of like having I almost feel like a bar light is going to be the best here, and have it towards the front half of the tank. Mm-hmm. So the back half is kind of dark, mm-hmm. and you want most of your wood probably in the back half of the tank, and that way like the Cory Cats can kind of come in and out of the light as they're doing their searching thing.
Oh yeah,
group up in their little mini schools or spread out if they find something good.
A fleet.
Oh, that's a good word.
I was
for that.
Like, I'd call it a gang, but
a
fleet,
gang.
But fleet
is perfect. And it's really, really interesting to watch Corys behave like that, and that's pretty close to, I mean, that's basically biotopic at that point.
Yeah.
Like it's,
I think one of the things that you're touching on a little bit, but I think needs to be said like definitively, if you want to keep Corey Katz and you want to keep them as a focus, you need a pile of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't do two.
Don't do three.
Don't even do seven.
Do like 12, 15.
Yeah. And if it's pygmy Corys, do 30.
Yes.
Or more.
when they're in such a large group, they're no longer a bottom fish.
Right.
In a group that makes them comfortable, if they're going to go up into the water column and
school.
This is the only way I know how to describe them. And it's going to sound so strange because it's going to sound so foreign to anything you've ever experienced in your life. A big school of pygmy Corys looks like a swarm of hummingbirds.
A swarm. Yeah. Nice. I like that word. That's a perfect choice.
If you ever look up videos of Cory cats in the wild, they are often in groups of 200
thousands
or more.
In some cases.
Yeah. And the behavior is mesmerizing. It's so fascinating to watch the way that they school or shoal depending on the environment, and they're beautiful and it's worth it. And having that sand there for them, having, like I talked about my buffalo heads, like multiple environments for them to explore for different purposes,
right,
allows you to see so much more of what they want to do than when you use them as an afterthought in your community tank.
Right. Okay, so let's break it down. You are designing the ultimate tank for a group of Corydoras whitespinae.
Yes.
What size is the tank?
I would say a 30-gallon breeder is the way I'd go.
Okay, mm-hmm. So that's a 48 by 18 by 12.
Yeah.
Oh, 36 by 18 by 12.
Yes.
Yep.
Just because I want to get like 12, 15 of them in there.
12 or 15, that's it.
In a 30-gallon breeder, I think so, because they eventually get a little stocky. But if you were going something like a 75, and then you did like 25 of them.
Or Amy's
64-gallon long, just with sand and driftwood for a group of 30 or 50.
That could be a phenomenal display.
Yeah, people really don't appreciate Corey Katz as a display fish. They're very often an afterthought.
Yeah. They're like, oh, let's get something for the bottom. I don't care what it is.
Just three cute little fish.
Design your tank around them. You can still accent that.
Yeah, like I actually wrote down, if you want to accent them, I think something like a cardinal tetra or
pencils. Or
similis.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or pencil fish. That's the word I'm looking
for. Pencil would be perfect. Something that's going to stay like almost as a unified group.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or hatchets.
Hatchets. That's perfect.
Like Corydoras whitespinae.
Let's just forget everything else we've suggested. Hatchets.
Yep, that's the right choice. Because they are going to, they'll still have that level of interest, but not, like, you want the movement to be all in the Corys so that they're the focus, and that would be perfect.
Then this group hanging out at the surface. Now, you'd have to be careful with your rimless tank because we definitely have to have the lid.
Yeah.
The hatchet fish. But I think we're designing an amazing aquarium.
Yeah, and if you really want plants in your tank, I would get some. Sorry, I had to do it. I'm saying that if you're designing around a Cory Katz, commit to sand, deal with it.
Yep.
If you set up your driftwood right, and that's actually something I've been experimenting with in one of my tanks, is you can actually create like almost, I don't want to call it shelves because wood isn't flat like that.
Yeah.
At least not the wood I'm using.
Banks.
And at these junctions of those banks between different pieces of wood, that's where I've been growing Java fern.
Mm-hmm.
So I really love the idea of having no rooted or plants at the bottom, but all your plants are kind of like, it's almost like a floating reef, but it's all plants.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
A good like 6 inches off the bottom.
Right.
Yeah. And then you're like, since they're not able to reach the substrate, they'll develop those really nice long roots from growing only in the water column. And it would just add so much more complexity to the root structure you've already created.
Yeah. I really want this tank to be like the inverse of the tank that you normally see, where it's like the plants are at the bottom and you got schooling fish at the top. No, I want my schooling fish at the bottom. And if you have to have plants,
yeah,
set them up in a way that they're in the top half of your tank.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
I want all my movement to be in the bottom half of my tank.
I think it's fantastic.
That would be so cool. I love that a lot.
All right, I'm totally like gonna run with his.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm getting skipped twice. Is that what's happening? All right.
No, you just got skipped once. It's just coming back around to you eventually.
All right, fine. Just let me know when I'm allowed to contribute to this discussion, okay?
Eventually. So, okay. So, and this was actually the first fish I thought of when I thought of this discussion. And it really takes the tank you just described would be perfect for this fish, only... Wait, what do you want? 30 gallons?
Yeah, minimum.
Yeah, so we're going to go four times the size, maybe even six times the size, to the 120 to 180 range. But we're still going to have a sand bottom. We're still going to do some driftwood in the back.
I was hoping you'd bring this up.
I love the idea of having just some plants up at the top, but Hygropinetophyta.
Okay.
Although maybe the green, sometimes red is an addition and sometimes it's a subtraction.
Well, the pinna grows green unless you really manipulate it.
Yeah, that's
like
true.
Like under, if you kept it low light,
yeah,
it should stay.
So give us the fish so I can comment on this because I want to know how to pair it with plants.
Earth eaters.
Yeah.
Ooh.
That's the only reason I didn't bring them up. And we could even almost extend it to like sand sifters in general.
Yeah.
I feel like you would want red plants because a lot of the earth eaters have like that greenish tone.
That's
to it.
True.
The peach face tapajos. So that would be Geophagus species peach face tapajos or redhead tapajos, either one, or all even right. Geophagus steindachneri.
You're right. It's gonna have to be booses.
Actually, the narrow leaf Java fern to me, I think might just do it.
Yeah,
at the top of that tank.
I think you're right.
But that. It's got to be big because these are fish that are going to get into the 5 to 7 inch range and some of them even larger. The Satanaperca geopyra. Yes, Satan's perch is exactly what that scientific name means.
I love it because like having worked with them in the last like month or so, it's probably the chillest geophagus I've ever seen.
It's one of the chillest cichlids you'll ever see. Like,
I just love the idea. Someone looked at it and they're like, Satan's perch. Like, yep. This is very clearly a name it got without anyone spending any time working with
they
it.
They just looked at a picture of it where its dorsal fin was probably a little messed up and went, ooh.
I think it's because they kind of look like a goat.
I think so too. Yeah, I totally think you're right. It's a little bit of a goat head look.
It's a pretty good hypothesis, yeah.
Yeah. The genus... is actually the three genera of earth eaters are Geophagus, Satanaperca, and Gymnogeophagus, which the Gymnos, the advantage of the Gymnos is they are from southern Brazil down into Uruguay and some of the other countries in that area, so they can handle some of the cooler water. You can do some of those down into the 60s. So if you, in an average house with a lot of the Gymnogeophagus species, if you just didn't put a heater on it, and weren't somebody who heated the heck out of your house in the winter and didn't cool it like crazy in the summer, but like set your AC at 76 and set your heat in your house at 70 or 72, which, you know, the variation that's going to happen there naturally, Gymnos would love that. And that would push them into their breeding stage. And then your substrate would always be clean.
Yeah.
When I had Geoparis, I used to go out to my pond and I'd take a little 6x12 standard aquarium net and I'd just run it along the bottom to pick up the leaf litter and whatever else was in there.
Nastiness.
Nastiness. And I would drop that into the tank with my Geoparis and they would devour it. They are true omnivores. If it is organic material, they want to chew on it. Leaf litter, twigs, seeds, algae, insect larvae.
So would you benefit from this in this tank in doing like a leaf litter over sand bottom?
The leaf litter wouldn't last.
It wouldn't. They'd just break it down too. You'd have to like replace it constantly.
Yeah. It was impressive.
But it would kind of be worth it. That would be really fun now, to watch them break down.
This is a serious question.
Yeah.
Because it just popped into my head. So if you had like hornwort floating in the back, would they go up and eat it? Because hornwort produces a lot of detritus.
That's true.
I'm not sure that they would. They're going after decaying material. That's where their fish brain is. If you could do plants, rooted plants in the tank, if you could set the plants so they couldn't uproot them.
Okay.
So I don't know that they would go after hornworms.
So if you stick, because I feel like that would be a really good like continuous snack for them, because like a lot of people, I do have people come in and talk about like how much detritus hornwort produces.
And I'm
like, it does, but it looks cool.
Or maybe like a really thick layer of dwarf water lettuce or something, because those roots are beautiful and they do shed kind of like hornwort does.
I never thought about putting some floating plants in there. That's a great idea.
That's a thought.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I like it.
Geos are so cool.
They are cool.
Are you doing tank mates in there?
They don't need them.
So it, depending on the plants, they don't need them. But depending on the plants, some surface, some schooling fish that tended towards the surface. If you're not doing plants, actually, I could see
hatchet fish.
What's that?
I said hatchet fish.
Hatchet fish. The big silver hatchets would be very cool.
That would be really cool.
Buenos Aires tetras, I think. Actually,
oh, yeah.
Talk about a fish that gets almost zero love, particularly around here, because they devour plants, right? And they're
fair.
A really inexpensive silver fish. But done right, and Buenos Aires tetras accenting those earth eaters.
They're so pretty.
That would be very cool.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's kind of the focus to me would be some bigger schooling, less accented, insert boring tetras.
Yeah.
But a
you
big
wanna,
school.
You want to add movement, but not necessarily color. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. Yep. So that you don't take the focus away from the earth eaters.
Okay.
Maybe a dwarf pike cichlids. They're just going to lurk up in the background.
In the wood in the background. I think that's a very cool concept. You know, maybe we just change the whole concept for the 100-gallon we're redoing right now.
That would be really cool. And it would also be easier than what we're talking about.
I don't want to take the easy route out.
No, we should spend the time.
We're gonna do it. So earth eaters, there we go. You don't need much light. I think I would probably put, if we're doing the 120, I would do the Awazi 350.
Those are our new favorite filters.
They really are.
They are. They're great.
They really are.
Yeah. There's my fish. Okay, Amy, now you can do your second
one. Oh, I get to talk now, which is funny because this is something that you've both alluded to a little bit.
Oh, good.
And I did the big group of schooling fish.
Ooh, no, go ahead.
To me, this is specifically in an environment where you want to encourage them to school, and that's the behavior you're trying to chase. How do you encourage that?
Predators in there.
That is one of the steps, honestly. The first step would be a large open space. We tend to do this.
Right.
What's the minimum tank size a cardinal can go into? 20 gallons. So we do a 20-gallon tank and we get our 13 cardinals and that's our school. And it should be like, what space do you want to fill? And then you choose the amount of fish that go in there. So basically, when we're talking about keeping a school of fish as a school, you want to limit grazing and exploring behaviors.
sorry. Just the way, I don't know why that's so funny to me.
It's just like, you're basically, because if they're close enough to each other that they can always see each other, there's no reason they need to school to see each other. So in a 20-gallon tank, they're going to split up and go into their little foraging mode and go and search for whatever they can, because they know they can always group up if they need to. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a group of 100 cardinal tetras in a 100-gallon tank, they kind of need to stick pretty tight even when they are foraging. So that's the first suggestion I would give to people, because some people, that's genuinely what they want out of a tank, especially the aquascapers. Second thing is, introduce some predators, and not necessarily fish that are going to eat them, but fish that are going to limit the time they can spend on the bottom.
So good territorial cichlids
that
are going to keep them out of the structure.
Yeah.
Oh,
because otherwise there's no reason for them not to just spend all their time hunting. Mm-hmm. Something has to keep them up and also make them a little bit uncomfortable, because schooling is a defensive behavior.
Yeah.
And it doesn't need to be a stress behavior, but it's easier for us to be together than to be apart.
So what fish would you use?
So the fish that I've used this method before with are pearl danios, but cardinal tetras, rummy nose tetras, any of the schooling rasboras. I mean, it pretty much works for most of these fish.
I think, and this is just anecdotal, I don't have any scientific evidence to back it up, but I think the longer and skinnier the schooling fish, the more likely it is to stay in the school.
I would agree with that.
Ergo, serpe tetras versus rummy nose tetras. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so I think it works best with like danios and skinny tetras.
Yeah.
I think I would argue that I think rummy nose are the easiest to get to consistently school, at least in my experience.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
So if you really just want
danios for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys are alluding to the next thing on my list.
Yeah, so large tank size compared to school size, you got to be willing to give them the space to do it. And
be willing to give them a proper group. If you're a consistent listener on the podcast, you've heard this before, but I recommend people literally buy their cardinal tetras by the dozen. The last time I bought a group, I bought 30.
Yeah.
That's how they should be. The Kabotai rasboras in the front tank. When there's actually 30 of them in that tank, that's when it looks the best. And if it was 15 of one and 15 of the other,
I don't think it would look as good.
Nearly as good.
But that one even, it doesn't need the predator. It just only has open space. So that's what they're going to do. When you've got this like super complex environment that it's worth it to get into the nooks and crannies, they're going to try that. I still recommend I would do your carpet or short area in the front, maybe some sand and some Corycats. And then if you in the back just have some stems or something like that, that'll encourage for most fish, particularly danios, that spawning behavior, which is going to make them show awfully well, but not encourage as much of the really hanging out in there all the time behavior.
All right, so break it down. So first, you came up with a bunch of examples of some of the fish that would work. So pick one.
All right, fine. I will choose my pearl danios because I think that that's a fish that actually deserves more love than it gets based on the coloration. And
so describe to me, if you will, the perfect tank to show off the carefully choosing the word right, amount of pearl danios.
Yeah, so I think a 75 would be a really great way to do it.
Went big. Go big or home.
A 55 maybe, but a 75, I think the extra width will get you a lot more fun.
Yeah.
And then 50.
Yeah.
I mean,
beautiful.
If you're willing to do more work, do more. But shallow front, probably a carpeting plant for me. Maybe a sand front, but I think you could do it either way.
I'm thinking basically trying to push, if people ask me this, I think now I'm going to be pushing people to look at our Upsarius danio tank and be like, replicate that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then some really great bushy stems like Rotalas in the back. Mm-hmm. Just because they will go and spawn in it. And that fish, when it's colored up, is stunning.
That's a fish that I think you could argue that pearl danios might be one of the most underappreciated, really colorful fish in the hobby. Like everyone just doesn't think they have any color, and it's because they only ever see them when they're not colored up.
And if you get the lighting right, and maybe a couple of Kessels or something like that, or I kind of like to do them with variable lighting. I like to give fish the opportunity for when they want to show off and when they don't. So that's why spotlit tanks are so beautiful to me, because when they want to flash and they want to show off, they will get a neon, almost like a neon tetra stripe along their spine that's bright orange, which is beautiful.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Normally they're pink and purple and orange, but that stripe is the really distinct, that's a mature, gorgeous pearl danio.
I think one of the things that people miss out on, that you won't miss out on if you're designing a tank around a fish with pearl danios and Weitzmanite corys as phenomenal examples of that. Both of those fish, if you actually see them mature in their full coloration, they're incredible.
They are. In a fish store, usually horrible. They're exactly. Silver, boring fish.
Yeah.
You get have you ever seen pictures of the pearl danios that Ken has in his tank?
I have not seen them.
They have a true mother of pearl sheen to them.
When I did zebra danios in my pond, They're not black and white fish. They're blue and gold.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the fun thing about a lot of these schooling fish, because they mature quickly, is you get that quick return.
Yeah.
You put them in an environment where they're comfortable and happy, and you're going to start to see that pearling. Of the reason a pearl danio is called a pearl danio is because of the pearl sheen that they get when they're mature.
Yeah, and unlike conditioning an epistogramma for 6 months to really get their full potential out of them, that's going to happen in a month or two.
Oh, yeah, easily. Yep, I agree.
But so many fish would benefit from a setup like that. And all right,
so
a 75-gallon
tank, 50 to 100 pearl danios.
Yeah.
What fish are you going to put in there to keep them?
Probably alert? A pistos. Rams would be great, but a pair of dwarf cichlids, and I think it's dealer's choice.
I like it. I'm just going to name drop one that I think people need to be talking about more. Enigmatochromis.
Ooh, I love that fish.
They might get a little big. No, you're
no, they get good. Like, they're you're smaller right. than Pelvicochromis.
Yep.
Yeah. The other one is like the slightly larger, a little bit more territorial Carassins. They can do it too, but really anything that sticks to the bottom and is a little bit territorial. They're not looking to prove themselves to these tiny schooling fish they don't care about. They just don't want them in their space.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I love it.
That's a
focus. That's yeah, a really good focus.
Everybody wants the school. This is how you get it.
Yeah. Filter?
Probably a canister for the flow. Mm-hmm. But it's not crucial. You could do a hang on the back in that if you wanted to. There's no necessary reason not to. Mm-hmm. Even a sponge would be fine. But I think the flow also will help trigger the schooling.
That's true.
Because they're just going to be more prone to playing up in the top, the upper levels right. of the tank that way.
Would you put hatchets in it?
Mm.
I just couldn't resist.
Nope. Not hatchets in this one.
Light?
Light, I think whatever's going to grow the plants you want. But I do really like to create different sections of the tank using light. I love my setup is two AI primes that sort of peak at different times of the day. So it sort of allows the fish to feel like there are different areas that they can play in at different times. And I think that drives different behaviors.
That's something I think people miss out on in the freshwater hobby, that the saltwater hobby actually, in it, from an aquascaping perspective, does well, is playing with that light a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Playing with light and playing with flow. Freshwater mm-hmm. people rarely play with flow.
Yeah.
But while it's not as crucial because you don't need to keep coral alive, it's still just as interesting to watch things interact with that.
It does very much change the behavior of your fish.
Really does, yeah.
The difference between the behavior of a school of... And I'm just going to stick with the danios because that's the easiest. Like the Apsaris danio behavior... when we added in that power head versus what they were like before, very different.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They are schooling. They're hanging out as this unified, almost their own organism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This collective organism.
And they want to hang out in this specific example, they want to hang out in that current.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. I think that's like the most extreme example of, yeah, they really want that because they are a hill stream danio. Not everything needs a ton of flow, mm-hmm. but.
They do it's come fun. From some pretty fast moving
water. They do, yeah.
Yeah. That's a great one. That's a good choice. I like it. I love the concept here now of we've had some pretty normal bread and butter fish. And here's, okay, let's make this bread and butter fish shine.
Yeah. I could have even gone with the zebra danio because I think they do deserve... They deserve to look beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. All right. Well, you basically led into my next one. So I'm going to lead off with a controversial statement.
I like controversy.
I think I'm going to argue that there's the one fish off the top of my head that I would argue benefits from having two species schooling in the tank.
Huh.
I'm thinking. Thinking. Nope, got nothing.
Celestial pearl danios.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So celestial pearl danios, to those who have never kept them, they are kind of a weird schooling fish, at least in my experience, because they only ever really hang out in the bottom third of the tank. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the normal methods of like trying to encourage them out into the open don't really work.
Yeah, my method would destroy Celeste. They would just be like hiding in the plants all the time.
Oh, yeah. They'd be very sad.
Yes, they would.
So Celestial Pearl Danios are my wife's favorite fish. Mm-hmm. So I have a big incentive to figure out how to make these look good. My cure, quote unquote, is Chopray Danios. And that's genuine. I bring them up a lot.
Yeah.
My love for Chopray Danios was because that was what I discovered was through experimentation was the ideal dither fish for Celestial Pearl Danios.
That is an amazing, unique fish that are incredibly beautiful. But how many fish can you guys think of that we would consider like a small schooling fish that hide all the time, almost no matter what you do? I mean, getting group, you don't ever see them come out as a group. They don't like, hey, check out my group of...
You can't really categorize them with anything else.
Mm-hmm. So you want to know how I would set up a tank for them.
Yeah, well, that's the whole point.
But because Charles, you're really pushing, you're like, how do you get these weird... I got the answer for you.
Cool.
So if I'm remembering correctly, Chopray Danios and Celestial Pearl Danios are actually found in the same region. And that's actually originally how I got the pairing.
I don't think so.
I'd have to double check that.
Because Celestial Pearls are endemic to Lake Inlay.
I think Chopray's are too.
I know the Fireline Daniel is.
Yeah.
But I don't know about the Chopray.
Okay.
Google it. I can look.
Celestial Pearl Daniels are from Lake Inlay. Where are the Chopray's from?
Not from Lake Inlay, but they're in the same genus.
Really?
Yes. So, Amy...
Yeah, this was news to me, too. Yeah, we just looked this up.
Just looked it up. I had a specific reason why I thought to pair these together. It wasn't due to geographic. It was because they're in the same genera.
Interesting.
But they behave very differently.
Yeah.
So Chopray's tend to hang out in the top half of the tank. Mm-hmm. They're a smaller Danio, mm-hmm. much like CPDs, except mm-hmm. CPDs hang out on the lower half of the tank.
Right.
So then I set up the tank where, you know how there'll be that negative space in the tank in the middle? Not, I shouldn't say in the middle, like two-thirds of the way down. And then you'll have plants on one side of that negative space and plants on the other. Mm-hmm. So if you set that up right and you slope kind of your plants up towards the corner, and I'm referring to slope as in height-wise, the Chopray Danios will hang out in the negative space in the middle. And they'll be kind of doing the, like the ones in the ellipse tank, they'll be doing a kind of a pseudo swarm.
Right.
The CPDs will mirror that in the bottom half of the tank.
Wow. Interesting.
So you want that slope, though, because the CPDs will be filtering in and out of the plants. And that's important. But they will be mirroring the behavior of the Chopray Danios above them.
Okay, that's kind of cool. And I don't think that's something that we've ever touched on, was fish mirroring behavior. We touch on dither fish as... sending out the signal that things are okay, but mirroring the behavior is a whole different thing.
Yeah, that was for me a completely unexpected result. It was just, oh, they're in the same genus, I'm sure they'll get along, throw them in together.
Yeah,
and then things got really interesting,
right?
Yeah. And I think it might have to do with a little bit of like the environment in Lake Inlay, which is a very shallow body of water with a ton of like random floating plants, and they are endemic with another Danio species that I wonder if that mimics their natural relationship.
A number of different Danio species.
Yeah.
But which one are you thinking of?
I know the Fireline is native there, which is pretty similar to the Chopray, just a little bit bigger.
Yeah.
And that's the only one I know of. I mean, the Lake Inlay Danio, but that's much larger.
Yeah. Yeah. The Erythromicrons are also
That's true. There.
I think the Sunda Danios.
I don't know about the Sunda, because those are from dark water environments and Inlay's pretty bright.
Lake Inlay is a high pH.
Yeah. And I think Sunda Danios are like soft water, black water okay. species.
There's something else that we're missing. Oh, Sabwa Resplendens, the Asian rummy nose, is endemic yes. to Lake Inlay. I wonder what that would have. What would happen if those were put? If that would there's got to be something. So I think what you're touching on is there's a certain behavior that the celestial pearl Daniels recognize as, oh, let's do that. We're good.
Yeah. And that's why I really wanted to talk about this one, because what you're purposely doing is creating a slightly different environment in the top half and back half, the top half and the bottom half of your tank yeah. to get that behavior out of these fish, the same behavior.
Right.
Because they react differently to their environment.
Interesting.
Like, because of the chope rays, they definitely are herded out into the open because I think they get kind of annoyed by weaving through stuff.
Right.
And then the chope rays are the exact opposite, but you want to find a way to get them to come out so that you can actually see them.
So I think this, we need to do an entire podcast on Lake Inlay.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about we need to do a biotope one.
Yeah.
I think the fish that you were thinking about is not Sunda Danio, but Microrasbora rubescens.
That is exactly what I was thinking of.
Yeah. Yep.
So what are those guys going to do? Yeah. Okay. This is, we're delving
just go
into
forever okay, on so Lake Inlay.
We could, cause it's one of those amazing
so
little micro ecosystems. That,
yeah. There's okay. a channa there too, by the way.
I know. Is there a betta?
There has to be. I don't know off the top of my head.
I only know of the channa, but I don't know. Maybe that channa is just that successful there that there's not a betta. If I search inlay on Seriously Fish, then just channa, Lake Inlay Danios, Microrasbora rubescens, Sabwa resplendens, there's Lake Inlay Loach. Those are the ones that come up.
Okay. All right, we're digressing.
It's so easy. So
size, filter, light, plants, other fish.
I would just stick, as when it comes to fish, I would just stick with these two. If you really want to do okay. these ones, because you know how it's like, most of our conversations today have been, just commit to the fish you want.
Yeah.
And you're setting up this tank for.
What size tank?
I think you would want to do like a 40 breeder or larger, because
it's hard to go wrong with a 40 breeder. I mean, that
because I think you really want like 20 of each.
Yeah.
Canister filter would be ideal just because you can hide it easier, mm-hmm. especially mm-hmm. if you're doing the sloping plants that I'm talking yep. about here. Yep. But if that's not your prerogative, you could easily get away with a hang on the back. Like, and then I think a lot of the plants can be dealer's choice, but I really like crypts towards the front, and then some easier stem plants like Rotala or Lewygia towards the back, or even like Vallisaria, stuff that
yeah.
like, you know, like the, I want the focus to be the behavior of the fish, so I don't really want anything too crazy plant wise.
Basically a low tech planet aquarium.
Yeah.
With the right slope.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hardscape.
I think I didn't think of hardscape at all, honestly. So I think you could do two options, and I think you have to commit to one or the other if you really in my head.
Yeah.
You either want to do like the peaking mountain Siriu or something out of the plants, or I don't know how to describe it, but when like you just have some Mansazita coming out of the plants, I think those are the two hardscape things that you really want. I think that if you mm-hmm. do too much hardscape, it's going to detract from what you're trying to do here.
It's nice for the fish to have like one big landmark to gather around.
Yeah.
But like other than that, you probably don't need much.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm trying to get at here.
That's a cool setup.
Yeah. You, hardscape.
That'd be a gorgeous aquarium.
And CPDs are one of those fish that you see a picture of and you're like, yes, obviously I want that. And then when you go to the fish store, you're kind of lucky if you see them. And when you get them home, you're like, it takes them a long time to get up, come out and actually start looking the way you want them to. So if there's a cheat to do that faster, I think more people would be more happy with their CPDs. I think
you're right. I'm being genuine in two statements here. A, we rarely don't have CPDs here.
Mm-hmm.
No one seems to know that.
they are a surprisingly Heidi fish.
I have a small group. So this is not the ideal setup here for that I just described here.
Yeah.
I have a 10-gallon in my living room. It's got a Betta, Cory Cats, and CPDs. The CPDs are always front and center.
Nice. That's awesome.
It's the right setup. The right fish with the right setup.
Mm-hmm.
It's the whole point of this whole talk.
So fun.
So do you want to go back to you? No, I've got a weird one, so I don't want to finish with mine.
I think I have a pretty good place to finish.
You got
finish.
A solid ending?
Yeah, I think so. I think I can like get there.
All right, so I'm going to do mine and then we can
Mine's
go
a bit of a weird one too, but I think I have a good way to end it.
Okay. So imagine, if you will, a Done. Hardscape.
All right.
And we're going to even do this in pick a size. 20 gallon, 30 gallon. I don't know. I wouldn't want to go smaller than 15, but you could probably do it in 15. And I want to see a sandy structure, but not a sandy area, but not a huge sandy area. And some smoothish, if you can find just the right pieces of lace rock, I would go lace rock. But maybe it would be, there's a stone, a mountain stone that we're getting that's got like a little bit of a variation to it, like a smoothness to it, like a worn look.
Mm-hmm.
With some of the chunkier pieces of driftwood that blend into it really well. But again, it's got to blend. It can't be. I've seen some setups for these fish where they're like, we're going to do a biotope for this fish. And I know I'm keeping it a mystery, right?
I know. I'm trying to picture what you're trying to talk
where
about.
Where there's like this really branchy sticks in the tank and it just looks awkward.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's because in an area where you've got big chunky stones, branchy sticks are not going to last long.
Yeah. But
chunky root systems, those are going to, and so maybe Mopani wood is the wood that you'd want to put in there. And notice I'm talking about things that are going to harden the water and soften the water. I am not worried about that kind of water quality because these fish can take it.
Hmm.
And here are some things that I said tonight about the behavior of fish and the behavior of good parenting sits.
Mm-hmm.
I want to design that whole tank around just the right pair of convicts.
Ah, when you said cichlids, I knew you were going to get there. I was like, no, he wouldn't.
I went there.
You went there.
Have you ever seen a full colored up convict?
You know, I'm going to say something right here. I love convicts. You just got to have some respect for them and you've got to have some affection for them. They're so good.
Now, if you were going to set up a tank that is the ultimate perfect habitat for a convict cichlid, you also better have a tank set up right next door for a predator that's going to eat the babies.
Yeah. Convicts are amazing parents.
And when they are mature, they are absolutely gorgeous.
They are so beautiful.
Rose, orange, and green sheen that they get on their grill plates is unmatched.
Yeah, I don't think that they're being done justice by being thrown into the bottom of every fish room.
They're thrown in the bottom of every fish room because they are so easy to breed.
It's true.
That the joke around the aquarium hobby, I maybe did come up with the joke. Right? At the aquarium club. If you can't breed convicts, you should buy a stereo. Right?
That's true.
Shout out there to Mike Mangi and Justin Sarnes. Both of those guys, by the way, are expert to guru level fish breeders who struggled for some reason with breeding convicts. So I got to give
them a little. It's just their burden to bear.
It's become this really, it's been a running joke now in the aquarium club for probably 5 or 6 years. I won't let it die.
Serious.
It won't go away.
I'm on a completely different tangent here. Sorry. So I'm just processing. I have never seen a white convict fully grown. Do they get a sheen to them at all?
The white ones? I don't know. I'm all about natural colored fish. Not a white.
Yeah, because I'm just thinking about it. I was like, the more I think about it, the more I'm like, who is the
individual
idiot that thought that was a good idea? Because I was like, yeah, they do get a lot of color as adults, and then that's why I was spaced out. I was trying to think, have I ever seen an adult white one? No. What do they look like?
They don't. I've seen an adult white one, and they don't. They're fine. Okay. They look like a baby white one. It's so. Part of the reason that this fish does not get a whole lot of love is because they don't have to color up to breed.
They don't need to have to grow up to breed. That'd be like babies having babies over there.
They could do that. I know somebody who tried to feed them to a piranha, and he ended up with 3 generations of convicts in his piranha tank.
Oops.
Yeah. And the thing about convicts is I do not doubt that for a second.
Yeah, they're badass little fish.
They are. You got to respect them. I know somebody who was raising a fajaca puffer and was like, I just need something to put in there, and decided to chuck in a pair of convicts. He does not have a fajaca puffer anymore.
It does not surprise me. I would not have made that choice.
He thought, you know, the puffer will kill anything else, and did not. It was like in a 100-gallon tank with a 5-inch fajaca puffer and 3-inch convict cichlids.
Mm-mm.
Did not work.
They might win the award for the best parents in the cichlid hobby.
I might even argue best freshwater fish hobby. Because they are so good at parenting that they're used as a model organism in the laboratory settings for modeling energetic demands of parental care. They are that consistent.
Brachardis from, I think, Neolamprologus brachardi from Lake Tanganyika. They would rival those as far as parenting goes.
Yeah, but they're lazy. They accept help.
Or they're smart. They accept help. How many moms do you know that wouldn't accept help? And you'd call
convicts
them
are like going alone. Yeah.
So they are found exclusively in Central America. They're found in a number of different ecosystems in Central America, although they have not, you know, we think of these as these ferocious little beasties. They haven't taken over. It's not like they're found everywhere in South America or in Central America. They're just in some particular areas, mostly on the East Coast from Guatemala down to Costa Rica, and then a little bit on the coast of Honduras on the Pacific side. And they're found in lots of different stream and lake type ecosystems. Flowing water's fine. pH from 6.8 all the way up to 7.8, because that's what you get in Central America. They don't do well in Lake Nicaragua, by the way. They have a very hard time there. It's just too diverse. Okay, so we're gonna go here. We're gonna go with a 20 long.
Okay.
We're gonna go with a pretty substantial amount of rock, and then some accenting blocky driftwood.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to put whatever filter you feel like rated to a 20-gallon aquarium.
Sorry, that's just perfect.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Sponge filter, hang in the back, canister, whatever. It'll
whichever fit. One. Every aquarium that the water needs to move on needs a filter. Right?
Yep.
Put one on, rated appropriately. 10% water changes once a week. Feed them fish food.
Something.
Something edible.
Yeah. And I would put some zebra Daniels in with them.
Oh, that'd be nice.
A group of about 12 zebra Daniels in my 20 long as a dither, a distraction, something to keep them interested.
Some extra movement.
And then watch the multi-generational familial, I can't say parental, because grandparents take care of grandkids in convict hierarchy. So the multi-generational familial care and the behavior, and that's what you're going for with that tank, is you are watching incredible behavior in convict cichlids.
There is something so amazing about a ruthlessly aggressive fish that will raise its grandbabies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, they will not tolerate anything else in that environment. But hey, if it's got blood related, we're good.
Even if it's just another convict.
If it's another, you know, it's like,
put more in. They're probably going to get along.
It's just so amazing that they are able to make that distinction and that that means something to them mm-hmm. in some way.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of how I want to word this question. So if you wanted a village.
A village, yes.
Of convicts.
A tribal society.
Yeah. How big of a tank would you need and how many would you put in there?
A village.
Like that's the, I don't know why that's the specific term I want to use.
Exactly where you're going with that. Heck, you know, why not? Let's pick on Amy's tank here and let's go with that 64 gallon rimless tank. And
I mean, like if there were three different little rock piles.
Yeah.
With that like diffused out. How would that society develop?
Let's take it up a notch, right? And if you're going to go with a rimless tank, you're going high end.
Yeah.
Let's throw that Awazi filter on there mm-hmm. with some of the Seachem stainless steel intake and outputs on it.
That would be gorgeous.
Because that steel would accent the lace rock and accent the sheen that those convicts mm-hmm. get. We're at 64 gallons now. We're going to start with 5 convicts and 18 Zebra Daniels. We're going to hang the lower end Twin Star light about twice as high than recommended.
Yeah, maybe dimmed down a little
bit. Dimmed down. All right. So, yeah, the metal legs on the tank, but dimmed down.
But with that color.
But
yeah.
When we do the aquascape with those rocks, we're going to spend hours getting the aquascape, analyzing elements of design.
Mm-hmm.
Balance and contrast and ratios and make it perfect.
While also taking into account all the things we've said today about how fish use space.
Right.
Whew, that's a tank that you'd notice from across the room and you would not be able to stop looking at.
I don't care where you are. You're putting that tank in a high-end spot with convicts.
Yeah.
You've convinced me. I went into this when you said convicts and I was like, I don't know, man. Seems sus.
That's what I was going for. I wanted to see if I could pull it off, but...
No, I'm all for it. I'm like, see, now you might need to put your money where your mouth is and set up that as the 100-gallon tank.
It's, you know, the thought actually crossed my mind because that's one of the fun things we get to do around here. We can put up a tank for a while and try it and watch it.
Yeah, we really talked about this a lot on the last episode, but like when a fish is loved, like so much goes, mm-hmm. like it just elevates that to this whole other realm. And all it takes is just somebody caring about it. Yeah. Doesn't matter what fish it is. If somebody cares about it. If somebody loves it, it's going to be gorgeous and it's going to be fascinating and people will understand.
That's why we do this, right? We all are into aquariums because fish are gorgeous and they are fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them have amazing behavior. Mm-hmm. They all do things to attract mates that most of the time involves something visual that we're going to look at and go, that's gorgeous.
Yeah.
They're going to do these feeding responses that are going to form this connection with us, right? Our human brain tries to say, oh, look, they like us. Look at them come. Yes, it's a feeding response.
Right.
But still, that behavior, that fascinating behavior is why we are so passionate about fish.
And yeah.
All of them have it.
Yep.
Yep.
There's no such thing as a boring fish unless you are bored by it.
that kind of describes it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Take a fish, design an aquarium around that fish, and watch it, and you'll be excited by it.
Yeah.
What are we finishing up with here?
All right. So that would have actually been a very cool place to end. But I do think I have somewhere to get us back to there.
Okay, good.
So I was thinking a lot about algae eaters.
Mm.
And to me, I think the most interesting way to approach algae eaters is through gobies. particularly the Styphodons, because I think they're a really fun fish to set up a tank for, and there are a lot of cool established ways to do that.
Yeah.
Styphodons need highly oxygenated water, but that doesn't necessarily mean like fast flowing water, although it's much more fun to do it that way. Mm.
That really erratic behavior where they're trying to position themselves right to maximize their efficiency in a current.
And they're so flat and well designed to do that. But they're small. They're like 2-inch fish. So a 10 gallon, plenty.
Nice.
Outfit it with a filter that's a little bit too strong. Whether that's a hang on the back, an internal, or a canister filter, it doesn't really matter. I keep mine in a 10 gallon with a 20 gallon hang on the back on it. Flow is appreciated. Plants will also provide a lot of oxygenation if you want to go that route. But why not both?
The right plants in good flow look awesome.
They do. And plants grow different. Like, so much fun in aquatic plants is because of how adaptable they are. Mm-hmm. So they'll grow different in faster flowing water than they will in slower water, just like they'll grow different under high light than they will under low light. Mm-hmm. And that's really interesting to watch.
And they'll grow different. Wait. And they'll grow different if they have nutrients in the soil versus in the water.
we're not starting that drama again here.
So wait for that video to come out.
That's the YouTube videos. That was a teaser. Keep going.
But their grazing and territorial behaviors, I think, are probably the most fascinating part of Styphodons. Mm-hmm. In the wild, they will basically select a rock or a little grouping of rocks, and that'll be their territory. And they essentially garden that space by going from one rock to the next, and eating all the film algae that grows on it. And that's where they'll try to attract mates. That's where they will make their little base camp. So when you're keeping them in an aquarium, you want to make sure that they have algae to eat. And it's not something we usually try to do, right. But algae eaters should have algae to eat.
Crazy.
Yeah, I often get a little like when people are like, I want algae eater to get rid of algae in the tank, and I get that impulse, but also I know that the goal is they don't want any algae in the tank, and I'm like, that
so then you gotta eat. Don't want an algae eater. So I actually will grow like garden little rocks for the gobies. I'll have a separate container, like a Tupperware, with a light over it, and grow out algae and swap that out with the rocks that they're grazing off of. And I think that's a really fun way to do it, because you do get to see them really establish in that space and really start to color up. Styphodons are shockingly gorgeous fish when they're fully colored. And it does take a little bit of work to get them there.
Have you seen the bookshelf style aquariums that are coming out lately?
That would be perfect.
So if we did, there's a, I think it's a 25x8x8.
Yeah, that would be perfect.
So 25 inches long, 8 inches wide, 8 inches tall, the input on one side and the output on the other side. So you get that flow and like you said, upsize the canister filter a little bit. So it's moving that water.
Yeah, you'd really get that.
That would be so cool.
And they're worth it. You could get a couple of, and I think this is also a fantastic setup for the smaller hillstream loaches or even the larger hillstream loaches. Mm-hmm. But I think an algae eater, like in an aquarium, needs algae.
Yeah.
And like, that's the foundation of what I want to say here. Like, if you want those, if that's really what you think is cool, if you want a hillstream loach in your tank, build it around that, feed them algae, understand that your tank should always have it.
And grow algae.
Yeah.
On purpose.
On purpose. And if you don't have enough, then swap it out with things that are growing algae on them.
Tank mates?
Hillstream danios, any of those faster flowing river species would be gorgeous. Don't even need to be the larger Borrelius or Upsarius. Even zebra danios would be fantastic in this setup.
Can they take that current? I think they can.
I think they can. More fish are more adaptable to more current than we like to think they are.
I'm trying to think. I know there are some betta species that come from hillstreams, but I think all the ones I can think of off the top of my head are big enough to eat a Styphodon.
Yeah, I was thinking of like the Unimaculatas.
Right.
But like, and this is different than the Styphodon setup that I'm talking about, but Unimaculatas with Suellia hillstream loaches, that would be a really, really cool setup. Oh, yeah. And that would be like the standard reticulated hillstream loach. Mm-hmm. There are smaller ones, but that would be the one with those fish.
That could be a very cool tank.
But I just, part of the reason I wanted to bring this up is just to flip on its head the idea that an algae eater is to get rid of algae.
Right.
No, algae eaters to eat algae.
Yeah. It's that they are fish that deserve to have an environment that they want to be in.
Right.
And so I keep my Styphodons along with my shrimp. And I don't keep super high flow in there, but I also keep a lot of plants for oxygenation. And I encourage cladophora, which is moss balls. I encourage hair algae a little bit. I encourage all those stuff that all those things are going to graze on, and they do better by it, and I have to worry less about them.
Hair algae is awesome.
Yes.
I love that stuff.
So that's like kind of my final word on plan the environment around the fish. Don't try and force fish into the environment you want them to have.
Can I have a quick rant about hair algae?
Please rant away.
So I mentioned the wood holding the plants up off the bottom idea that I've been working with. So my original plan for that was to pair Java ferns with Christmas moss. But then somehow, like, that thick, short, brushy hair algae start growing on it. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, wait, this is way easier. Yeah. And looks pretty cool.
Yeah. It can be beautiful.
So I've got like a short little layer of it, almost looks like moss, like on tree branches. It's so cool. I love it.
It sounds perfect.
I don't know. That was the rant. I was just even I didn't go into that thinking, like, my first thought was, crap. Like, how am I, like, once you get hair algae or anything like that inside of moss, you're never getting it out.
Right.
But I very quickly decided that I liked, in this case, this type of hair algae more than the moss itself. So I pulled all the moss out. The Java moss.
I have a hard time accepting it, but I can totally see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just our bias coming through.
Yeah.
But algae, excessive algae is the result of excess. Healthy environments have some algae in them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, like, if you don't have that much excess, you'll still grow algae, but it'll probably be small and short and fairly pretty.
I like it.
So, I don't know. I thought that would be a good one to end on, just because it's that, like, think about what your fish are going to want. Is there any other that we missed that are on your backup lists?
You know, that everything.
Yeah, I know. I could have gone like archer fish or mud skippers, or I didn't go with any really dramatic fish like that. I went with stuff that I just like to keep and I think deserve to be loved.
I think we did a really cool, all around encompassing fish from totally different ecosystems, totally different environments, totally different places in their own ecosystems.
Mm-hmm.
That if you focus on that fish and focus on, I don't want to just say that fish's needs, but on an environment designed around them, that you're going to get the most out of that fish. But not just the most out of that fish, you're going to have a better aquarium.
Yeah.
And pretty distinct.
Yeah.
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 Like, each one of these tanks would look drastically different than every other tank we talked about today.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Everybody comes in the shop going, I want that strange, unique fish because I want something nobody else has. What if you take something everybody else has, but do it better?
Mm-hmm.
Do it right.
I wouldn't say do it better, but imagine just being able to dunk on everyone because you have by far the best display for any fish we talked about today.
I think you just described doing it better.
By yeah.
Way. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's so good.
Yeah.
And it's also like conversations about aquariums often tend to be conversations about bare minimums.
Mm-hmm.
And like, what's the least I can get away with? But like, not often are we challenging ourselves to say, what is the best we can do?
Yeah.
And
that's it.
It's more fun to say, how do I do this the best than it is, how can I get away with this the most?
That's it. Sometimes it's fun to get away with something.
It is kind of fun to get away with something.
We all have a junior higher.
Oh, like, yeah.
A junior higher in our body.
I mean, but, and even still, it's yeah. like, can I get away with? And there's plenty of areas where I still want to experiment in, like, what's the least I can do, just so I know where, like, where I'm coming from. But, like, when it's a display, to me, it's how can I do it the best?
So now I do have to completely rethink all of the displays in the whole shop. Every one of them. Oh, it's painful.
No, all right, I'm fine. Let's redo them all. That's okay. Fun.
Well, that, I mean, that is an advantage that we do have around here, that we get to do that.
I mean, we've got hundreds of fish. We could redo them all.
Yeah, there we go. Well, so there we go. Let me know what you guys think of this one. If you have a fish that you've thought, you know, I really love this fish and I like it in my tank, but it's a favorite. So what would be the best ecosystem for this fish?
Or even better, if you figure that out and want to tell us how to do it.
Yeah.
I would love to hear it.
Let us know. Show me something that you did that said, hey, this fish was cool, and then I did this. And now it's my favorite.
I'm thinking of a couple that we had that had a 60-gallon cube with like 50 pea puffers and like designed the whole thing around that.
Oh, yeah.
And I was blown away. I'd never seen anybody do that before, but they did it so well. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to see.
That's a lot of the kind of stuff that we can do around here. Let's face it, we're always about trying to figure out how to do it right and do it a little bit better. Or at least do it really well.
Yeah. And please send us your ideas. We're definitely going to post a conversation question on our Facebook page, but you can also email us at podcast@watercolorsaquariumgallery.com with any comments, questions, or just thoughts that you need somebody to hear.